What is up, y'all? This is Connie Morgan with the Free Black Thought Podcast. Today's guest is Adam B. Coleman, author of Black Victim to Black Victor and founder of Wrong Speak Publishing. He is a frequent contributor to the New York Post, the Federalist, Newsweek, and many more news outlets. Adam was raised by a single mom and openly writes about his struggles with fatherlessness, homelessness, and masculinity. We talk about his political perspective, his childhood, and his recent weight loss triumph. It is a well-rounded interview covering a variety of topics because, remember, there is no such thing as the Black perspective, just Black people with perspectives.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.
Adam, thank you so much for joining the Free Black Thought Podcast today. It's a pleasure to have you on. Back when we started this podcast, or when we were talking behind the scenes about starting this podcast, we knew, like, Adam Coleman went on the short list of people that we were going to invite on. We didn't get you in season one, but here you are for season two, and we're stoked to talk to you. And there's a lot we could talk about. But just like with all of our guests, I want you to start at the beginning. Can you please kind of tell us your origin story, how you got to where you are today?
Yeah, how I got here today is a very unusual route. The very first thing was that, I'll explain, I'm an IT guy by trade. Back in 2020, I was working in my office on a daily basis, experiencing COVID like everybody else. You know, had questions about COVID, had questions about different narratives that were coming up, and then George Floyd happened, and it was like everything just kind of went on its head culturally. And there was a lot that was happening that I didn't agree with. There are also people that I generally agree with that they weren't saying the thing that I wanted, you know, to be heard in the world. And so I figured the only way for me to have my voice out there is to actually use my voice. Mm-hmm. So, you know, prior to that, I didn't use social media. I had a Facebook account that I barely use, only for friends and family. And a lot of people really didn't know my personal politics. I was very private about my political positions. And no one really needed to know. Mm-hmm. So for me to do what I'm doing now is like the polar opposite of what I was doing prior. But the very first thing I did was write my book, Black Victim to Black Victor. I had never written a book. I have no formal writing, you know, background. I don't even have a college degree. I went to trade school. Mm-hmm. So it was just something where I know how to communicate with people. And I wanted to find a good faith way of communicating a somewhat controversial message, you know, within my book. And I'm really happy to know that people who've read the book see it as a good faith attempt to talk about something. And they don't take it as a political book, but more of a cultural book. Mm-hmm. And they, even if there's something that I say that they don't agree with, they understand why I'm saying it, where I'm coming from. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of storytelling that's in it. And I think the storytelling aspect really helps to kind of understand me as an individual. So yeah, I started with that. And after I wrote the book, I self-published it. It took me about 8 months and I just wanted to market it. That was basically it. And long story short, it spawned into a writing career and doing commentary, being on television, having a Twitter audience and building my Substack platform, where now that's kind of what I'm doing full time. So it's been a wild ride meeting people that I used to just watch on the internet, and now I have their number, or yeah, I've been on their show and I've talked to them. So it's very weird.
But also super inspirational. Like I think a lot of people in our audience either are starting to, you know, they maybe started a Substack, or, you know, they're interested in doing that kind of thing. And to hear that you've built this huge, what I would consider a huge platform in just 4 years, basically, really even a little less than that, because at first you were probably just more focused on writing your book and stuff. And you weren't, I don't know, did you kind of go full hog on Twitter at the same time as you were writing the book and Substack?
No.
That came after. So it's been even a shorter amount of time that you've built. Like a really, so you have like 100,000 followers or something like that on Twitter. How many do you have?
120.
There you go. Wow.
Yeah, I think 120. And actually to really put it like in perspective, I published the book I believe at the end of March 2021, I got on Twitter, officially got on Twitter and started using it August of 2021. I think by September 2022, I reached my 100,000.
Yeah.
It was something like that. I've obviously slowed down because I don't use it the same way like I did before, because I'm busier and I have other things that I focus my attention on, and I try to use Twitter a little bit differently. But it was a lot. You know, I've been writing for the New York Post, I want to say a year and a half, consistently, almost every week, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's been a whole bunch of things that have happened in a very short period of time.
Did you pursue some of those writing opportunities, or did they come to you? I mean, some of the like the New York Post and some of the other platforms that you write on now or have written for, how did that work? I think our audience would be interested in that too. A lot of people probably want to do what you're doing and are like, where do I start? Like, if I haven't written a book, but I have great ideas and thoughts that I want to put out there, how do I do it?
So one thing, I'll answer that question. One thing I want to emphasize, me writing the book was kind of the shortcut. It doesn't seem like it, but when you write a book and you do it in a timely fashion, that means that you're writing almost every day.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote Monday through Friday. I think in that 8 month time span, maybe like the last month and a half, 2 months was editing, but I'm still writing.
Yeah.
And I think I took 2 weeks off the entire time.
Wow.
So I'm writing every day and I'm finding my voice. I'm getting more and more comfortable. I actually had to rewrite earlier parts of my book about 3 months in because my voice had changed, my tone had changed, and my ability to write was getting better. And so I had to go back and like one for one kind of rewrite what I was saying before in the right tone that I wanted. And so that's why actually it took a little bit longer to finish, mm-hmm. even though 8 months is
pretty short.
pretty short. But so I mentioned that because by time these opportunities came, I was ready. Like I knew how to write. I knew what my voice was. I knew what my tone was. Whereas most people do it the opposite. You know, they're writing and it takes them longer to find their voice and find like the tone that they want, the vocabulary that they like using. You know, all of these different things kind of come into play. So when the opportunities came, for me, it was just mastering what I wanted to say in 750 words. Mm. That was basically it. And it's a little bit different of approach from writing a book to writing articles. But if you have the right tone and what you're comfortable with and the balance and your approach in writing, then it's not that hard of a transition. But to answer your question, my opportunities with the New York Post especially was purely by accident. And I tell people all the time that Twitter is LinkedIn if you use it right. Mm. 90%+ of the opportunities I've gotten have come from Twitter, because everybody who's in the political space is on Twitter. So you might actually get somebody's attention, and that person's attention might lead to you connecting with somebody else, connecting with someone else. So it's one big networking opportunity if you see it that way. And that's been my general approach. I don't use it like a diary, like most people do. I do a lot behind the scenes. I cultivate relationships with people. I'm reliable. I'm, you know, dependable when someone hires me to do a writing gig. But it's an interesting story for the New York Post. So I had scheduled a tweet. I happened to be in Wisconsin doing a speaking engagement. And there was a guy who was taking me around, but it was my last day. And so we were kind of hanging out before I went to the airport. So I scheduled a tweet in my hotel room. He picks me up. We go to breakfast. We're talking. I get in his car. We're driving to the airport, go through security, make it to the gate. And I hadn't looked at my phone the entire time. I look at my phone and I'm like, oh, crap, I'm going viral. I had no idea. So it was about Joe Rogan, the Joe Rogan controversy with, I think it was Media Matters, put in a compilation of him saying the N-word, completely out of context. Because Joe Rogan's saying, like, this is bad, you know. So I had tweeted something out. I don't remember exactly what I said, but it caught on. So then Newsweek had reached out to me, and another publication reached out to me to write an article. So I wrote an article for both. I submitted it to Newsweek, and she reached out to me and said, oh, you know what? I'm so sorry. I can't publish this. Someone else wrote something that sounds similar to yours. I'm like, well, what should I do with it? She's like, I don't know. Send it to New York Post. I'm like, okay. Do you have an email? She gives me the email. I name dropped the editor and the subject line and sent it. 24 hours later, great article. It's going in today. I was like, what? Yeah. So I actually have, my wife got the first article put in a like a plaque.
Oh, yeah.
We have it hanging up on the wall. Because honestly, I had no idea if I'd ever write again for the New York Post from there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was probably like a month later, I had another opportunity to write for them. And then it just started turning into, they would reach out to me and ask, do I have an opinion on this story? And then I would write.
Yeah.
And then it just quickly turned into a really good relationship between myself and the editor, and then her bosses liked my work. So it would turn into her bosses wanted her to reach out to me and ask me if I'd write something, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, all of this stuff to excel, if someone's trying to build a career, networking is the most important aspect of it. If you're contentious, if you're antagonistic, that means less people want to work with you,
mm-hmm.
right? And it makes it harder for you to spread your wings, especially if you're starting from zero.
Yeah.
So I think that's been the biggest part. And now, like, these editors become personal friends. You know, I'm in New Jersey. They're in New York. The editor I'm talking about, Kelly Jane Torrance, she's been to my place a few times. She was just here a couple weeks ago, and we hang out, have dinner. And you just have these relationships, like a genuine relationship with these people, because a lot of them are really good people. But I think that's important, not to do it in a fake way, but to do it because you actually care.
And I will say this, I've interacted with quite a few people through Free Black Thought now, quite a few influencers, thinkers, talking heads, whatever. And mm-hmm. oftentimes we talk behind the scenes here. It's kind of funny how unprofessional is probably too strong of a word, but how flaky a lot of people can be, where they ghost you, or they, you know, it's fine to, we're not big on deadlines here anyways at Free Black Thought. We are all volunteer. And so things get published slowly here. It's very rare that someone would submit something like you did. And we're like, we're publishing it tomorrow, because we all have day jobs and do other things, but
right.
It's not even that. It's just the communication. And even just with the few times that we've interacted with you, either with doing the journal or doing the podcast or whatever, you are very efficient and you're very reliable. And I will say that we're shocked all the time by how unreliable a lot of people that are kind of in this public thinking space are. So we definitely appreciate that. And I would just tell listeners, like, be reliable, be dependable, because it does make us want to work with you over and over again. Even if, right. And this is not the case for you, but like, even if you were someone whose writing wasn't as strong, or you didn't have as many unique opinions or whatever, but like, hey, if we know we're just going to get content from you, like, that's half the battle a lot of the times. So we really appreciate that.
And if I can add,
yeah,
especially a place like the New York Post, it's a little bit different than other publications, because the New York Post still prints newspapers. And I actually, every time I have an article, I go to the store and pick up a paper, because we're creating like a scrapbook of all my articles. But because that is a thing, they have strong deadlines. So I know that I have to have this done by this time, because the editor needs it by this time, because it eventually needs to make it to the paper, and they need to print by a certain time so they can send it to have it delivered at a certain time. So like, all that stuff really matters. So I might hear stories about other writers who flaked, and it messes everything up, and it becomes like a last minute scramble because they have hard deadlines. So I'm very happy to say there's only been one time that I didn't stick with the deadline, and it was only because it was a miscommunication as far as what day she wanted the article.
Yeah.
And, you know, I apologize, won't happen again. It's never happened again. So,
yeah,
you know, cause I'm like, Saturday at this time. Yes. Okay, cool. Rather than it being like tomorrow, or you want it at 4:30, which day 4:30, you know,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. So I make sure that the communication is clear, that I'll have it by this time, by this day, you know, and I'm 99%+ of the time I stick to what I say.
Yeah. Wait. Yeah. We love that. And it's very important. And it's shocking how not rare, but how frequently people aren't like that.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your origin story a little bit. You said that the kind of, you were, COVID was happening and you were sort of disagreeing with some of the, you had questions. You had questions about the way things were handled. So what were some of those questions, I guess? What were some of the things about COVID? Was it everything? Was it just you thought the total approach, or were there certain parts of the handling of the pandemic that made you go,
I mean, down to, so I'll tell you one thing. It becomes very suspicious when people tell you you're not allowed to ask questions, right? Not that I'm asserting an opinion. I'm just asking a question because I've never heard of this before. Never in my life have I heard you must stand 6 feet away from somebody for any reason.
Yeah.
And so when I asked someone, a former friend of mine, now a former friend of mine, I asked them, you know, and what is this about? Like, what is the 6 feet about? And they're like, don't be ignorant, you know? And I'm just like, why are you coming at me? Like, I'm generally asking a question. Never heard this in my entire life, in my 30 plus years of living at the time. Like, I've never heard this. So, you know, that becomes a very suspicious thing when someone says you're not allowed to question a particular narrative, especially for how you're supposed to live. You're just supposed to pretend that this cloth mask that you put on him is stopping the deadliest virus in the world. Like there's something about this is very strange. But the aspect of you not being allowed to ask questions actually really bothered me. As someone who's very private, you know, I'm asking a question because I think it's important to ask that question. I'm not trying to assert something. But I think when George Floyd happened, it was much of the same mentality. You're not allowed to ask these questions.
Mm-hmm.
You're not allowed to question a particular narrative. And, you know, it's one thing for me to choose not to speak. It's another thing for people to tell you not to speak.
Yeah.
So that action of people saying you're not allowed to speak, you're not allowed to ask questions, you're not allowed to counter this narrative makes me want to speak. And that's kind of what happened.
So did the pandemic and George Floyd combined sort of red pill you, or did you already have hold the positions you had before all this? And you were just, like you said, very private about it and didn't want to share. And that just put you over the edge where I ain't going to be private no more.
Well, actually I started becoming red pilled prior to COVID. And actually not long before COVID. Just by coincidence, I'm a former Democrat. I would say a moderate liberal.
Okay.
And I would call myself a liberal at the time. And what's interesting is these days, my positions haven't changed all that much. The political climate has changed more than I have.
Yeah.
And I don't even know, a lot of people call me a conservative. I guess on certain things, on other things, I'm kind of liberal about. Yeah. It just really depends on what it is. But I'm politically an independent. But I started becoming red-pilled prior. I've written about me meeting a man in Spain, actually. I went to Madrid. I met him randomly in a pub. I was watching some games. And he's originally from the UK. So we just kept in touch. And we would talk about football. I'm really, really into European soccer. So we would talk about that, and then we eventually got into politics. And at the time, he told me he was for Brexit.
Mm-hmm.
England leaving leaving the European Union. And I thought that was interesting because I'm over here thinking I'm informed. I'm watching MSNBC, and they said the only reason they want this is because they're racist and they hate foreigners.
Yeah.
And I asked him, that's interesting. Why are you for Brexit? See, I had good faith in him. He's never shown me any sort of ill will or anything like that. And he told me the United States would never allow an outside governing body to tell it what to do. And I said, that makes a whole lot of sense because we wouldn't like that. And what he was advocating for was autonomy from a bureaucratic body like the European Union, where they can decide what they want to do as a country, how much fish they can fish. How they can move about within their country. and not have some body that's in Belgium that has no interest in what they do and willing to sacrifice what their country does for the betterment of everybody else for everything. I completely understood what he was saying. So he was a really big influence as someone who is a British conservative. And we just started getting into all different types of audiobooks and stuff like that. We would binge them together.
And that's then, so awesome. What a lovely, I mean, happenstance. Like, who can just get a friend? Like, that's amazing. Anyways, go on.
Yeah. Actually, and I'll tell you this. So it's even, so I'm a Christian. And it's even more timely than I just met him randomly at a pub. So I knew, obviously, I planned my trip to go to Madrid. And I'm also a real Madrid fan. So usually when I try to go to these certain cities, I want to go see a game. Mm-hmm. And I thought I saw that there were no games at the days that I was going to be there. So I make it to Madrid. I'm doing a walking tour and I get an alert. There's a game going on and it's at home. I was like, what? How is that possible? So I went and I started watching it at some bar. And then Chelsea, which is my number one team, is an English team. Their game was about to come on. And so I went to go to an English pub and watch it. So I went to one English pub. I went in there. I was in there for a couple minutes. I was like, I'm not feeling it here. So I left. And then I went to another English pub. And I stayed there. I watched the game. The game was over. We had a last-second goal to tie the game against Manchester United. I still remember all this. Anyways, so the game was over and I'm like, all right, well, I guess I should go. It was beautiful and sunny out and then boom, torrential downpour. And I was like, well, I can't leave. I have nothing. Like I don't have an umbrella. I have nothing. So I'll just sit here and wait. There's more games that are on. So I stayed there and I watched the next game, which was Manchester City. I can't remember the team they were playing against. And so I moved my seat and I just happened to sit next to him. And we just talked. So all of those events happened for me to end up sitting next to this guy. And since this political awakening, you know, we've kept in touch. I was actually just in Spain a few months ago. I stayed at his place and he got to meet my son. And the year prior, my wife and I went to Madrid to see a Real Madrid game. We finally got to see one. And we saw him and his wife was pregnant. She was like a week from giving birth. Mm. So, you know, we all got to meet each other and see each other as a family. So I got to see her pregnant. And then a year later, I got to see the baby, a year old. So it's all that from being just like circumstance. And I feel like, you know, all these things were supposed to happen.
Right. There's no for us Christians, it's not a coincidence. Yeah.
Yeah.
that is so, so cool. What positions have changed, I guess, for you over this course of you sort of like finding your public voice?
My position. So policy position wise, the biggest one is abortion. I was pro-choice. I am wholly pro-life. I am radically pro-life.
Welcome to the club.
You know, even that transition to pro-life got even more radical because there's a pro-life with an asterisk that a lot of people who are pro-life. Well, if the mother is raped, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't want to tell a woman who's raped that she can't.
Yeah.
But then I when I think about it logically, I say, why are we killing a child because of a single heinous act? It's not the child's fault that this happened. And then I met Shamika. Shamika is one of the most vocal people who's a product of rape, who was born. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, is Shamika's life less valuable because of how she was created?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then I talked to some women who were raped and had children. And they said, despite what happened, my child is a blessing.
Yeah.
And I just thought to myself, you know, if life is precious and we don't like to say that, you know, the sins of the father are carried over to the son, that's not what we try to practice.
Right.
Why is this the asterisk? Like, mm-hmm. why is this child's life less valuable because of what the father has done? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of the thing. And I feel like in politics, you know, political positions are what it is. And I just, some people sacrifice certain things to get other things done. But, you know, people like Shamika are sacrificed mm-hmm. Because, you know, they don't want to seem insensitive. Well, listen, she was raped and I don't want to say, and it's right. a heinous act. Mm-hmm. But the child did nothing to deserve being killed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I'm radically pro-life as well. And I use the scare quotes for that because the term radical, to me, there's only two honest positions that you can have on abortion. Mm-hmm. Either it's a human life, and that means it's valuable and we shouldn't kill it, which means to you, everything you just said, even when it's conceived out of rape, incest, I don't care. It's a human life. We should protect it from start to finish, from conception, you know, all the way forward. Or it's not a human life and you should be able to abort. You should be able to kill after the baby's born. I mean, you should be able to abort 2 minutes before the baby's born. That's actually, to me, and they'll say that's radically pro-choice. But to me, we're the only two actually honest people. Now, I think they're wrong, right? I think it's mm-hmm. a priceless human life. But if your view is that it's not a, you know, human, it's not a human life, is it priceless? Then sure, kill, fire at will, basically, you know, kill the baby whenever you want. And so, but they call them radical and they call us radical. And I'm like, we're the only two people following the logic of our conclusions all the way out, you know? And so I almost hate, I'll call myself radically pro-life because people generally know what that means. But sometimes I just want to say I'm logically pro-life. that's all I am. I'm just following the logic where it leads. So definitely appreciate that point of view. Any other opinions of yours that have changed or morphed?
That, for the most part, the media has its biases and it has no problem lying to you to make money. Mm-hmm. I think that was the wake up call for me. And Trump ended up being like a case study of the media lying that I didn't realize. So like the easiest one is good people on both sides. You know, I had been watching CNN, MSNBC, I've been watching all this stuff and I was, just like how I'm astute with politics today, I was very astute with politics then. My problem was that I was getting half of the information. I was getting very one-sided biased information. And the perspective of the right always came from the filtering of the left. And I never watched right-leaning publications to understand what the right actually thinks, how they see these things. I always listened to the left-wing narrative. And so I was making a false assessment on what was going on based off of media lies. Mm-hmm. So when, or media bias. So when they say that the president said there are good people on both sides and what it's implying, but they never show the beginning part where he says, I am not talking about the white supremacists.
Right. Yeah.
You know? And so when you hear that over and over and over, and you can imagine my thinking when I finally heard the full clip and I was like, holy crap, this entire time I think it was like 2 years by then, I've been hearing good people on both sides, good people on both sides. You turn on The View, good people on both sides. The president's a racist. He said there are good people on both sides. You know, you start hearing this stuff over and over and then for like your bubble gets burst. And so that was a realization that these people will lie to you in your face for years upon years to force a particular narrative that benefits them. And they don't care if they don't care about the truth, if it's inconvenient. But the lesson that I learned by leaving the Democrat Party wasn't to run into the arms of the Republican Party because they're just as flawed. They're mm-hmm. just flawed in different ways.
Yeah.
And in many ways, they use the same tactics. You just replace a noun and it's, you know, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. So like, for example, the left says we need to preserve democracy, right? We need to save democracy. The right says we need to save our nation.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's just like you just swap a noun. It's the same mental framing that they're trying to imply. You know, the country's overrun by insurrectionists, the country's overrun by racists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they're these are tactics. These are fear-mongering tactics. These are specific narratives that they're trying to use. They're just trying to cater to an audience that, for the right, they see themselves as patriots, right? They mm-hmm. see themselves as patriotic. So if you use words like nation, right? We need to save our nation, right? It's very patriotic sounding.
So that's the
biggest thing that I learned. And that's why I'm an independent today, because I don't want to get wrapped up into someone else's views. I don't want to get wrapped up into, I'm a Republican now, and dare I criticize what the Republicans do? No, because everybody's always looking for the traitor, right? Mm-hmm. You're not a real Republican. You're not a real conservative, all this other stuff. So I choose to vote whichever way that I want. I would gladly vote, and this probably might be the most controversial thing I'll say in here. I would gladly vote for a Democrat who's common sense, who wasn't an elitist, mm-hmm. and who wanted to bring some sort of normalcy, mm-hmm. and obviously wasn't abundantly corrupt.
Yeah.
Because there are lots of good, moderate Democrats, and not all of them are far left progressives. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a difference between the two. But I'm not just going to vote for some crazy person who's on the right who says illogical stuff because they're not a Democrat. I think that's as dumb.
Yeah.
You know, so what I like someone who is sensible, common sense minded. I don't have to agree on every position. Mm-hmm. And even on the abortion thing. The abortion thing doesn't come up in every, like, if someone's running as the county commissioner, why are you asking them if they're pro-choice or not? Like, it doesn't matter. It literally doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's that kind of thing. I just want smarter politics. That's all.
Yeah. And to the abortion point, actually, I've attended the March for Life a couple times. And the first mm-hmm. time I went, I was surprised that so many of the speakers were Democrats. Like, they have Republican and there was more Republicans. Don't get me wrong. There was a lot more Republican speakers, but there was like at least 10 Democrats that were politicians that went up and gave speeches, pro-life speeches as well. And they were none. Of course, I had never heard of any of them because they don't get platformed by their party. And so then I started thinking like, well, what is the history of which side's pro-choice and pro-life and abortion? Like, I know it used to be that no one really even talked about abortion. Like, it wasn't even really, everybody was kind of pro-life back in the day because everybody was Christian kind of with no matter what side of the aisle you were on. And right. So I started doing research and I found that at one point, about 40% of the Democrat Party, whether it was, you know, national or local politics, were pro-life. And now that has changed a lot to the point where you probably won't become like a famous, you won't get the party nationally won't uplift you if you're a pro-life Democrat. You can be successful locally, especially if you're like in the Bible Belt. That's where a lot of these pro-life Democrats were, right? They're right. Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, those places. But I didn't even, it didn't even cross my mind that there could be more than a few random pro-life Democrats. But that's kind of how the parties have changed too, in a way. Like, I personally see it more with the Democrat Party. Like, you must have these, they, it's not like we have a wide tent or a big tent, you know, and all kinds of different left-leaning folks can join. It's like, no, you will not have a career in this party if you're pro-life is at least what I'm perceiving to be true, just from my experience of going to the March for Life a couple times. And here are all these pro-life Democrats that nobody's heard of because nobody's ever going to choose them to on the VP ticket or whatever, you know, nationally. Right. But I was like, a pro-life Democrat, these moderate Democrats would do great. A lot of people are craving exactly what you want, right? They just want sensible leadership. They don't want people who, you know, are radical and on either end of the spectrum. And so I find that really interesting. Like, it almost seems like self-sabotage. Like, if the Democrats could just put forward somebody who was kind of a middle of the road blue dog Democrat or whatever, they would crush. At least that's what I think.
Yeah. You know, I have a friend who's out in California, and everybody, you know, California is so liberal, Democrat stronghold, but, and this person is in politics, and they were running for office. And her name is Tamika Hamilton. She was running for office in a D plus, I'm trying to remember if she said D plus five or D plus six district. She almost won. And it, and the reason she almost won is because she's not crazy. Yeah. You know? And even the other day she was telling me, she's like, I talked to so many Democrats who would love to vote for a Republican, just not Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And it's because they don't see Trump as a sensible candidate.
Right.
And I think there's things that become so polarized. As someone who's been paying attention to politics for well over a decade, I think there are people, there are two aspects. There are people who are new to politics, probably because of Trump. Trump got them interested in politics, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And it goes on both sides. You know, Trump, if you were more liberal leaning, Trump getting into politics makes you pay attention because you think this guy's insane. Yeah. If you're more right leaning, he got you into politics because he's speaking to you for whatever reason. So, but I've been paying attention to politics much longer than Trump. And there used to be a thing that has always been a thing, but they want to pretend that it's not a thing, called a swing voter.
Yes.
You know, which is why we have swing states.
Right, right.
Right. So there are people who are more moderate, who are open to voting for either party, depending on who the candidate is. Mm-hmm. But things have become so polarized that that message, because these people haven't disappeared. They've always been there. But the message is that they don't exist anymore. And I think that is a silly message that gets perpetuated. And I think it gets perpetuated on both sides, that these people no longer exist. And I've written for the Post talking about this. You can alienate voters. Like, swing voters are more likely to sit at home and sit on their hands. Mm-hmm. Why should I vote for either of these candidates? I don't like either of them. They're not giving me a reason to vote for them. And a lot of people don't like that. They say, well, you know, be a grown up, choose the best of the worst.
Right.
Right. But it still doesn't negate the human nature of it. Most Americans don't vote.
Yeah.
Right. That's the reality of it. So if most Americans by default do not vote, regardless of who the candidate is, and you make it so that the small population of people who do vote, and you want to ruin it for them as well, yeah. Right? Like the goal is to get more people to vote for your candidate. Mm-hmm. And so the objective should always be that, but it always feels like the objective is to be like, those people don't matter. They don't exist. I don't even know what a swing voter is. They're just flaky people, blah, 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 and just casting them to the side and catering to the most extreme and dumb aspect of either party. And that's what I see happening on the right, and I see happening on the left when they're catering to the progressive left, who have the most insane concepts. Like we talked about abortion. It used to be pro-choice, right? That was the moderate position. I don't want an abortion, but I don't want to take that away from somebody else. Mm-hmm. And now it's pro-abortion, which is a completely different, you know, viewpoint. Yeah. They've just catered to the extreme left, mm-hmm. and alienating people like myself, who was on the left. Mm-hmm. So I think there's the hyper-partisanship has alienated a lot of people who are just like me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I my family, at least my nuclear family, were all kind of aligned politically. And like many people, right-leaning, liberty-oriented people, we're not the biggest fans of Nikki Haley. We don't love her. And I know Twitter kind of hates Nikki Haley. But the truth of the matter is, Twitter is not real life. Nikki Haley is seen as a moderate. And, you know, I had a conversation with one of my close family members the other day, and I was like, according to polling data and just kind of common sense, like, Nikki Haley would crush Joe Biden. Like, that's what the polls are telling us. She's seen as kind of a moderate, level-headed person as opposed to Trump. And this family member didn't like that I said that, because they're somebody who listens to politics every day, and, you know, they're plugged in, and they hate Nikki Haley because they're sort of, they're knee deep in politics, but most people aren't. Most people are just glancing at headlines. They're just sort of going along to get along. They just want somebody they view as sensible. And so Nikki Haley looks like a great candidate for them. And that's, so it's on both sides of the aisle, right? Like, each side is not great at picking the candidate that is most appealing to the, you know, the most people.
Right. No, and you're absolutely right. And we saw that in New Hampshire. It was literally the polar opposite. I think it was 70% of the people who voted for Nikki Haley were swing voters or independents. Mm-hmm. 70% of the people who voted for Trump were Republicans. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. So it, like, just that as a microcosm tells you everything. And listen, Trump may be the nominee. He's likely to be the nominee moving forward. But that should be some sort of a warning sign for people when it comes to the general election, that he might quite possibly lose because he lost the middle. And I've been like ringing this alarm. The amount of people who said I'm one, there were two-time Trump voters who said they were done. That's kind of a warning sign for me. The amount of people who are like, we want DeSantis because they see DeSantis as a more serious and more moderate type of person. I wouldn't say completely moderate, but a more moderate type of person.
At least in temperament.
In temperament, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think temperament matters. A lot of people don't think it matters, but it really does matter to those very people. Because if the only time they see this person is when they're screaming on the top of their head, or when the media cuts them up and shows the most outrageous clip of them talking for an hour in front of a crowd, like, that doesn't help you, mm-hmm. right? So you need somebody who is sensible, who you can't take out of context so easily, who won't be bombastic, who won't be these things, because a lot of regular people are just regular people, and they don't think that the president of the United States should be some sort of angry madman. Right.
Right.
But they, at the same time, they really don't think the president should be some old guy who doesn't know where he's at. Like,
yeah.
Right. So it's like, which one do you choose when it comes to that from someone who is not political?
Right.
You know.
Right.
So
those of us who are online need to just remember most people are not online. Like, most people are not listening to a political podcast every day. Like, most people are not reading any article every day, let alone one about politics. Like, that's just not how regular Americans live their lives. Okay, so since we got into it, is your finger on the pulse? Like, what do you think is going to be? I know people hate to make election predictions, but I'm seeing both. So I'm seeing folks, like you said, that are like, I'm done with Trump. I voted for him twice, or I didn't vote for him the first time, and I voted for him the second time, but I'm not going to vote for him the third time. But I'm also seeing a lot of people that now, because Biden's presidency has been such a failure in so many ways, are going to plug their nose and vote for Trump, even though they're like, I don't like him. I still don't like him, but I'm like struggling out here in this Biden world. So what do you think? I mean, I do not know, and I'm not great at predictions, but I truly am like, I'm flipping a coin. I don't know who's going to win. I don't feel like I have a good finger on the pulse of the country right now.
So, all right. So I'm going to say this, and this is not what I'm advocating for. I'm just trying to give a prediction, and I'm trying to base it on a bunch of different factors. So if we go to 2020, Biden didn't campaign. Biden basically sat at home. He did not campaign. Trump was on the campaign trail constantly. He was always giving speeches. Yet he lost. And so you have to ask yourself, why did he lose? And take away from the people, the election was stolen. Stop. Like, the election did not hinge on Philadelphia and Atlanta. Stop it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, no one in that common sense right of mind thinks that a black majority city like Atlanta was just the holdout for Republican votes. Like, stop it. Do I think that they're a funny business, whatever? Probably, but not enough for Trump to lose, right. Trump to win. And on top of that, I honestly thought that Trump should have won by a landslide. Mm-hmm. That, in my opinion, it should have been McCain versus Obama. But anyways, so Biden was able to win by making this a referendum on Trump. Mm-hmm. So now I'm looking, is Trump in a stronger position or a weaker position? He's in a weaker position. He has indictments all over the place. And while the right thinks this makes him some sort of martyr, that's not how regular people see it.
Right.
Right. The regular people who just turn on the TV for 2 seconds see that, man, this guy's always in legal trouble. I don't know. Do you want to employ anybody who's in constant legal trouble for any job? No, no. Like that doesn't look good, mm-hmm. right? It's one thing to have one situation where people want to focus on it, like, oh, maybe. But when you have constant legal battles, when you have everyone who's in your political circle is being indicted, like, it, I'm not to say that he's guilty. It's to say that it doesn't look good, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so he is in a weaker position. He is spending campaign funds on his legal fees.
Right.
Like, I think he's at the majority of his campaign funds go towards legal fees.
Yes.
That's not good. That means that's not money that goes into him actually campaigning and right. trying to market himself. His political positions haven't really changed, mm-hmm. right? His temperament hasn't really changed. He's still kind of the same temperament person. If anything, his shtick is losing steam. Mm-hmm. Like even his rallies seem smaller. Mm-hmm. I see less of an impact that he is making. Now, anything can happen between now and in the election. And yes, Biden isn't the greatest of presidents. But if we're to be fair in an unfair way, and I say unfair way because we often attribute the state of the economy to being the president's fault, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's good or whether it's bad. Mm-hmm. So at a particular moment, the economy was doing well when Trump was in office until COVID. Trump is amazing. And I know a ton of people who are like, I'm voting for Trump just before COVID. COVID happens. Everything that happens towards COVID is held in Trump's fault, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if we're honest, the excess of spending started yeah. under Trump's administration. Oh, yeah. Inflation started under Trump's administration. Biden didn't help. He didn't help. So whichever way you want to try and slice it, who's at fault and who's not? I think there have to be something really special circumstance for people to get over. If they already had a negative viewpoint of Trump, there would have to be something really special to happen for someone who voted for Biden prior, actually not voted for, voted against Trump prior, right. to all of a sudden vote for Trump. I think it is more likely for someone to be like, I don't like Biden or Trump. I'm staying at home. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. That to me, that's the more likely scenario. So that means that there are less voters. And so if there are less voters, who does that actually benefit candidate wise? I think that benefits Biden.
Okay, well, it's out there now. That's your, and I'll say too, with the past, the Trump election, this is our third one. my gut feeling has been wrong each time. So the first time he ran, like everybody, I thought he was going to lose. Though I remember I went and voted and then I was out for a run afterwards. And it was very calm. At the time I lived in a little town in Washington, a rural town in Washington. It was very calm. I'm running around and it's kind of like dusky. And a truck drives by and it has a huge Trump flag in the back. And I kind of lived in Trump country. Because like I said, it was a rural area. And as I'm running, I'm like, will he win? I was, you know, is he about to win right now? I think he might win. No. And then I even went to bed that night and I woke up and Trump was the president. That was crazy. And then the second time I thought he was going to win. That was my feeling. Mm-hmm. I was like, it'll be closer than people think, but he is going to win. And then I went to bed and he was winning. And then I woke up and Biden was president. It was like the opposite each time, like the opposite of what I thought. So my like gut tells me that I think he's going to lose this time, like, but I'm not really sure. And because I'm so bad at predictions, I'm like, well, then maybe he'll win because I've been wrong twice before. My gut always seems to be off. And also I've never voted for a winning. I said this in the last podcast I recorded. I voted in three presidential elections and I've never voted for a winner. So that'll give you some clues as to how I vote, but I'm a three-time loser on presidential candidates, which is crazy. How do you lose three times? But okay, so we have the Adam Coleman election prediction. What does your family think about what you're doing now? Like your wife, has she come along with the ride on the ride? Like, or is it like, hey, we don't talk about politics at home? What your family has to be like, you were this quiet IT guy and now you're like on TV. Whoa, it's got to be crazy for them.
I've been very fortunate. So when My wife and I, we were official in September 2019.
Okay.
So just before COVID started happening. But remember, I was starting to transition politically, right, so to speak. And so I was curious about a bunch of stuff. And by the way, during my transition, I wasn't just like listening to conservative stuff. I actually listened to progressives. Mm-hmm. I said, I'm on the left. Let me listen to independent progressives. Started listening to Jimmy Dore, Kyle Kulinski. I really tried when it came to like Cenk Uygur. And it's just, it was, at the time, it was insufferable. I couldn't listen to them. The Young Turks. So, And then I was like, all right, I think I got what I got from this. Let me listen to conservatives. Let me listen to libertarians. So I kind of went like the full spectrum. But I remember it was shortly after we started dating, and I sent her a Larry Elder video. And she told me later on, she's like, when you sent me that video, I was thinking like, oh my God, I don't know if this is going to work. Because like, you know, she's Black, her family's from Brooklyn. They're, in my opinion, default Democrats.
Yeah.
And so, you know, she's never considered the other perspective. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was just showing her. And that's the one thing that she likes is like, I don't try to force things down people's throat. Like, we just talk about stuff. And if she agrees with me, then that's fine. If she doesn't, that's fine as well. So, you know, I would show her certain things and we would talk about certain things, but we'd always talk. We never argued over politics. Yeah. And I think over a period of time, she was just kind of like, yeah, that makes sense. And then especially because of my book isn't a political book. It's more of a mindset kind of thing. And someone told me it's a self-help book. You know, and my wife would read it because I would write something. I would send it to her and she would read it on her way to work when she was on the train. And so her reading it and realizing like, yeah, I have this mentality. Yeah, I need to get better when it comes to like having the victimhood mentality. And she started just implementing these things and having a more conservative look on life. Mm-hmm. Not by me saying having a more conservative look, but just saying, like, I think these things are beneficial. So she's kind of shifted her way into pretty much like a similar position of being an independent. But at the same time, I tell her, like, I don't want to talk about politics. Like, I talk about politics all day with certain people, but I just want to talk about everything else with you. And, you know, so... We don't really discuss politics. Yeah. It's pretty rare, but she supports what I do. As far as my family goes, my family is actually very proud of me. Doesn't necessarily mean that they all agree with what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But they're very proud of me for all the things that I've been able to accomplish. You know, I went to Ron DeSantis's reelection event and my cousin went with me. And you know, we were in the VIP meeting all these donors and influencers and stuff. And he was like, man, he's looking around. He's like, we all been here, you know, getting free drinks and free food. So, you know, he's like, he's very, very supportive and we'll talk about stuff, but we'll always be like, but you, my cousin, I love you. You know,
that's
and
wonderful.
We keep it going. So, you know, I've been very, very fortunate because I know so many people who've lost family members because of politics.
Yeah.
But my family has always embraced me. Like, how can we support? You know, we care about you. We love you. My in-laws have come around. I would say for the most part, my in-laws have come around when they actually got to know me. And sometimes you have to battle what people hear about you.
Yeah.
I remember one of my relatives was an in-law. He was like, I heard you're a big Trump supporter. And I said, I am. He's like, are you? I was like, I don't know. I never voted for him. You haven't? No. and then we started talking and then I would show him the book and I would talk to him about it. And he was like, I really like you. Like, cause it was our first time really having an exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing because I'm a human being and I'm pretty rational. I'm not very extreme. And the times that I find that people don't like me is when they have an avatar of who I am because of some other quote unquote black conservative who says X, Y, and Z. So you yeah. must think and say the exact same thing. I'm like, no, actually I don't. Like, yeah. I don't have a problem with Black History Month. You know, like, you know, you celebrate or you don't. Like, it doesn't matter. You're in a free country.
Yeah.
You know, so it's stuff like that. When people actually talk to me and actually get to know me and don't assume, then everything is good. So to answer your question, my family has been very supportive. My mom's been supportive. You know, my mom subscribes to my Substack and sometimes texts me. She's like, "You're right." She's like, yeah.
"That's nice. So, yeah. That's so good. You're blessed, man. Like having that friend come into your life, having your wife come into your life at the time that she did, and her being the person that she is. I mean, this is, I feel like your career is totally God's fingerprints are all over it. And just the way everything came together in perfect harmony yeah. is just awesome. And we're getting into kind of the personal side. And so I guess it's a good time to ask you about some other sort of personal things that I've been seeing you
sure.
Tweet about quite a bit lately. And I actually think they're kind of related. You've been talking a lot about fatherhood and fatherless homes, and actually your weight loss journey as well. Maybe you don't see the two as connected, but I sort of do in the sense of being, you know, having being a masculine presence and the importance of that and how physical appearance is a part of that and your personal health. Can you just, for those who don't follow you and haven't been following kind of your recent, you know, thought process on fatherhood and fatherlessness and then the weight loss journey, Can you tell our audience a little bit about both of those experiences for you?
Yeah, absolutely. To kind of go from the beginning, you know, I grew up without my father. You know, he was always married, but he was married to somebody else. We were the other children. So, you know, I'm the youngest of the two. My sister's 4 years older than me, but he wasn't really around. And then on top of that, we moved around a lot as well.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I was 18, we had lived in 4 states, and even within those states, we moved a bunch
Big
of times.
Moves. Wow. Yeah. So yeah. Did he have other children that he did spend time with and he just kind of ignored y'all?
So here's the interesting thing. I know he has other children. I have no idea how many he has. And part of the reason why is because my father is a lot older than my mother. So when I was born, my father was 50, my mom's 24.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. So I know he until he passed away a number of years ago, I know that he was married. I know that he has at least one child. That child might be my mom's age. I have no idea. And so I really don't know anything about that side of my family, my father's side. I met my cousins like once and I met my grandmother, his mother, one time. So it was like all in the same time, but I don't have a connection to them. And on top of that, he was from Trinidad. So I don't have any connections to Trinidad at all because I never had an opportunity to get close. You know, so to answer your question.
So those other family members, were they still in Trinidad or were they in the United States? The grandma and cousins and stuff?
So I think when I met my grandmother, she was visiting.
Okay.
But my cousins lived in, this was in Massachusetts when I met them. They were living in the States. So I think it might be a mix between the two. I think there are family that are in the States and a family that are in Trinidad. I remember my father would always go back to Trinidad. I knew that was a thing that he would do yearly. And I remember asking him as a kid when he did come around, like, "Can I go with you?" And he would always kind of like not answer my question and just kind of keep it going because he had no interest in doing that. Have I ever been in Trinidad?
Yeah, since then, or have you ever?
No.
And you wouldn't even know who to call. You have no connection to anybody there.
No, I don't have a connection, and honestly, I don't really have an interest.
Okay,
I think that left a long time ago. Mm-hmm. You know, as a kid, you have a natural inclination to want to be close to your father. But when that doesn't happen, you're just kind of like, well, that's what it is. But I think that's my relationship with my father was always kind of like, we were inconvenience, you know? And when he saw us because we were more so a pit stop. So like we were living in the Northeast at the time. And, you know, whether we were in New Jersey or in upstate New York, but he was a tailor. He would drive through to New York City to meet friends that he knew from Trinidad and pick up fabric. So he would stay with us for a couple nights, but he wasn't there to see us. You know right. what I mean?
Yeah.
We were just convenient. Part of the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a place for me to put my head while I'm traveling. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that was kind of the relationship I have. And the thing that always sticks out to me was that when my father would come and would stay with us, he would never say goodbye to us.
Hmm.
Like, because he would always leave in the middle of the night.
Ugh.
So, and it wouldn't be one of those things like, hey, I'm leaving at 4 a.m. to get an early start. You know,
right.
here's a hug, kiss, love you. It was none of that. I didn't even know he was leaving. He would leave in the middle of the night and he would leave $50 on the kitchen counter.
Wow. So had he passed away before you've done anything that you've done now?
Oh yeah.
I'm assuming. Yeah. Yeah. So he didn't get to see any of this. Do you think he would have regrets if he saw where you are now and what you're doing now and wish that he had played more of a role, or do you think he just didn't? He was never going to care no matter what.
I don't think he very much cared at all. I've talked to so many people because a lot of people like to inject their particular situation with their father or themselves as fathers, where the mother is keeping the father away, or, you know, the father just wants to wait till they're adults. But that's not my situation. My mom really didn't try at all to keep us away from him. He could call and he would call randomly, but it always felt like I would talk to my father on the phone because he was calling my mother, not because he wanted to talk to his kids. You know, same thing with him stopping by and seeing us. My mom wasn't arguing with him to not stop by. He would just stop by when it was convenient for him.
Mm-hmm.
That was basically it. And as an adult, I had my son around the age of 21. And so like I thought about all these different things, you know. And so I was like, you know what, let me try. And I called him at his shop because he had his own business as a tailor. And I called him at his shop and I said, hi, you know, this is Adam. And there was silence. And I was like, your son. And he was like, oh, okay. You know, and it was, I don't remember the conversation because it was very short. And it was very uncomfortable. And it almost sounded like if your friend calls you while you're at work,
yeah,
right? Like, yeah. Listen, I'm at work, you know, I'm a bit busy.
Yeah.
That was the vibe that I got. Not, I'm talking to my son who I haven't talked to in about 5 years.
Oh my gosh.
You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So at that point I was like, why am I trying?
Yeah.
You know, so that was the last time I talked to him was when I was about 21. But I said I would never ignore his calls, but he just never called me. He never tried, never attempted to, never tried to call my mom to find out anything about me.
Yeah.
Just went complete radio silence. And I found out that he died because my mom told me, but she happened to find out that he died about 3 months after he passed away.
Wow.
So like, that's how like disconnected we were, when it came to him. So honestly, I don't think he would even know.
He doesn't. Yeah. He's not paying attention at all. Is and someone like him acting the way he is it that there's to me, it seems like there can only be kind of two paths here for someone to be that way. Either they have so much internalized guilt and shame over the situation that they don't like, it's too much for them to even have to admit that they were wrong or that they mishandled things or that they've been a horrible father or whatever, or like they're a sociopath, like, or is there a third route? Like, what do you think it is to just totally reject your child? Like, because from what you're telling me, your dad wasn't a drug addict. He wasn't an alcoholic. He didn't have some of these other things. Like, he was a perfectly functioning cognitively like person. He didn't have some of those other factors that you see kind of breaking families apart. How can someone just be so flippant about their own family? I don't know. What's your theory?
I think that my father found a young woman that he could have sex with. She got pregnant the first time. And I think, because it sounds like my sister had more of a relationship with him than I did.
Hmm.
But when she got pregnant a second time, my mother told me, I don't know if this is true 100%, but I don't doubt it. My mother told me that he wanted her to get an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I don't think he wanted to build any sort of family.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He wasn't being exactly careful. So I think he was a married man who wanted to have his side piece. And having one kid was one thing, but having another kid and building some sort of family was something that he didn't necessarily want, because he had his wife, he had his family. He wasn't trying to start fresh. So I think it's one of those things where you just go into the silo of I have my real family. And you don't focus on us. And honestly, that's the, you know, I see it with certain parts of my family. My grandfather is the same way. My grandfather, had a bunch of kids with his wife. One day just, you know, they separated and he never came back around.
Mm.
That was basically it. And I happened to see him. I saw him, I think twice in my life. Yeah, I saw him twice. Once at a relative's birthday party, and then I think it was like the next year at that same relative's funeral. Mm. And I just happened to see him. Didn't seem very interested to see his grandkid.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a very unfortunate situation, because he started his family over. He had another daughter, and he got remarried and all this other stuff, and left his kids behind. And I see how that affects them.
Did your dad's wife know about you guys, or were you a complete secret the whole time?
I highly doubt she didn't know about us. Like, my mom was taking child support money from this check. You know, I highly doubt she must have known.
Jeez, Adam, like, everything that you're telling me about your personal story, it makes you more amazing, because in my opinion, you know, the father represents God in the family, like that leadership, that headship. And so that's why it's so devastating when the father isn't a good father, isn't around, whatever. Even if the father just dies in a car accident, you know, and isn't around for that reason, it's like God has failed you in a sense. And that's devastating when people feel like God never fails us. But when people feel like or have the impression that God has abandoned them or whatever, how many movies, stories, books, you know, have been written about that struggle with God and that relationship? It's the same thing. That the father is our like human representation of that in our home, and when we don't have it, it's absolutely devastating. And then you're telling me that your father treated you this way, but then other patriarchs in your family also weren't there, also didn't step in to fill in the holes necessarily. Maybe you do have someone that did step in, but at least you didn't. You've just been doing this for you to turn out how you have. I mean, it's incredible. So what are you changing with your own son? How have you been the generational change, and what is your mentality now as a father yourself? And you've been a father for a while, but
yeah,
tell me about that.
So I've said this before, that my son forced me to become a better person. Not that I was a bad person, but forced me to mature. Because I you know, it's not like I had him at 15, I was 21, but you know, you never feel like you're truly prepared.
Right.
And on top of that, I didn't have a blueprint as to how to be a father.
Yeah.
And honestly, I wasn't a man. I tell people all the time, I didn't become a man until probably I was in my early 30s.
Mm.
Like, just 100%.
How do you define that? How do you define becoming? How do you know you've become a man?
When you finally start listening to yourself, when you accept leadership, when you understand the level of responsibility that you have completely, have confidence, at least a good amount of confidence, not necessarily arrogance, where you don't question yourself so much, right? And my struggle was I always doubted myself. I didn't understand who I was because I didn't have that male figure to back me up.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So I always led things with questions. I always put too much emphasis on what other people thought, especially women. I put too much emphasis on what women thought of me. Is she going to like me? You know, I was, you know, kind of that person for quite some time, which is like woman repellent.
yeah, you got to have the confidence, the swagger, right?
Yep. You got to have some confidence about you. So it took me a long time to get over that aspect, a lot of failure, but also just like looking at my son and seeing how impactful I am for him. But the first thing I told myself after my son was born is that I wasn't going to be my father. Mm-hmm. So quite literally, I just had like a blank canvas of how to raise my son the best way that I possibly could. And my son is a lot like me in temperament. Mm-hmm. And I think he's always been like that. He's always been a happy child. He's a happy baby. And I didn't want to ruin that for him, mm-hmm. you know? So like, there's the behavior that I learned from growing up in a single parent household of, you got to spank, right? There's a, Black people, we beat the shit out of our kids. So we must spank. You know, like that's just what we do. And I never liked it. I never felt like I needed it. And I felt like when it came, it didn't have to come. Mm-hmm. I never liked being cursed at because mm-hmm. I felt it was unnecessary. You don't have to curse at me. I was a relatively sensitive kid. And I saw that my son was like that. I never cursed in front of my son until maybe like when he started becoming a lot older, like 16, 17. He might hear me once in a while curse.
Yeah.
But now he's 18. But I didn't curse in front of my son. I didn't play any music that had cursing. And I stopped spanking him very, very early on because I didn't like it. And I felt like, I was like, why am I spanking him? Like it was a conscious decision. I'm not going to spank him. I'm just going to talk to him more. Mm-hmm. And that's literally all I did. And I never felt the need to spank him ever again. Mm-hmm. Because anytime something's going on, I talk to him. I put him in punishment if I needed to.
Yeah.
But I realized that my son is much more fearful of disappointing his father than getting mm-hmm. spanked by his father.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so like I understand that. And like I've yelled at my son, not cursed him out, yelled at him because I was disappointed. And my son's cried. Mm-hmm. Right. Because he doesn't want to disappoint his father.
Right, right.
But you know, so I don't need to put my hands on him. Mm-hmm. And so I've become very like anti-spanking. And I think that's, honestly, I think that's the shortcut of a lot of single mothers because they mm-hmm. don't have the time. And it's a frustration that comes through in a physical form, mm-hmm. Especially when you're dealing with young boys. But it doesn't work that long. Like, I remember when I started becoming big enough, like my mom spanking me wasn't that big of a deal. Like when I was a little kid, and her cursing me out just made me hate her more. Mm-hmm. Like I, you know, you don't have to curse. Like I understand English. You can talk to me, you know, you know? So I don't know if I'm kind of going all over the place, but I was able to figure things out because I made mistakes and I just wanted to be, a better version, of the father that I thought I always wanted. So that's how I treat my son. My son knows he can talk to me about anything and everything. I tell him, do not lie to me and we'll figure it out together. Mm-hmm. The only time I've ever been extremely pissed off at my son was when he lied to me.
Yeah.
So, you know, he doesn't lie to me. We talk honestly about things and I want him to feel comfortable telling me these things. So that's the kind of relationship I wanted to build with him.
Yeah, you've completely flipped the script. And what about your recent weight loss journey? We're talking about how you're getting new headshots, you're feeling good, you're looking good. I love when you follow someone, like I follow you on Twitter, and you're used to seeing them talk about politics or whatever. You know, that's mainly the world that I live in, kind of culture, politics, commentary type of stuff. And then one day, you know, you just put out a tweet like, hey, I'm also, this is a little bit about my personal life. I'm on this weight loss journey. And oh, the support you got, like people love hearing that kind of like humanizing stuff about the folks that they follow. And I definitely was one of them. I was like, oh, that's so awesome. So what spurred you to start this? And where are you at now in the weight loss journey?
So what started it was, there's always a moment where you're just kind of tired and you just need something to kind of get you going. My weight has been an issue my entire adult life. I've always fluctuated. There have been moments where I've lost massive amounts of weight, and then over a period of time, I gain it back. But I think this time is different. One, I have more people who watch me. The second is that I finally like psychoanalyze myself as to why I keep ending up in this situation. And I've concluded that I have like a food addiction issue. Mm. And so if I treat it that way, someone might be like, no, you don't have food addiction. But it actually helps me to see it that way. Because if I see it that way, it's much in the same way as an alcoholic that says, I've been clean for 124 days, right? Mm-hmm. It makes me keep an eye on what I'm doing. It makes me mindful that that thing that I'm about to eat is full of sugar. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I'm not going to eat it, mm-hmm. right? So it's made me... saying that out loud, and I've written a Substack article saying this about myself, has actually helped me mm-hmm. to see things that way as to why I keep ending up in this particular situation. But as far as how I lost weight, I lost it by doing all the right things at first, you know, eat less, work out a little bit more. But what really stepped it up was doing intermittent fasting. Mm. I want to say in like a 3-month time frame, I lost about 40 pounds. Mm. Wow. Like it was ridiculous. It would be like 5 pounds in a week. Like it was just dropping off. Mm-hmm. And I started utilizing that. And what intermittent fasting teaches you is to be very mindful over hunger. When you feel hungry and you choose not to act on it, because it comes in waves. You know, you really start taking control over how you eat and why you're eating. Do you need to eat this? On top of that, I was eating very clean. We cooked every meal. We didn't eat out. I was exercising. So at the end, I want to say, would it take me, I forgot how many months now. It was basically from April to December, I think I lost 70 pounds.
Wow. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That is awesome. Where should people go if like intermittent fasting is like kind of all the rage right now? I hear people talk about it all the time, but what's the best resource for how to do it right and do it in like a healthy, productive way?
So that's a great question. I always listen to doctors. I was watching a lot of YouTube videos. There are doctors who praise intermittent fasting, but they break down as to why it's beneficial and how exactly it works. So like one of them is Dr. Mindy Pels. You know, she talks a lot about it. And on top of that, she talks about it as an older woman. So she gives a female perspective on how to approach fasting, because it's different because you have your cycle, what you should do it, what you should not do it. And she gives very general fasting advice as well. How to approach it, how to sustain it. What not to do if you're doing it too much, all these different things. So I was actually watching a whole bunch of doctors on YouTube who mm-hmm. were breaking down how it works, why it works, how to approach it. And it's more than just like, oh, you're starving yourself and it's a caloric deficit. It's more than that. There are all different types of things that are happening to your body. Your body's becoming more efficient. So that's why you'll hear people say, I fast and I'm more clear-headed, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Or I fast and even though I'm losing weight, I don't get saggy skin, right? And there are reasons behind it. So that's generally what I was doing. I was looking at all these different YouTube resources and I always listen to the doctors rather than the gym guys.
Okay, yeah, good advice. Yeah. Though a lot of people don't trust doctors these days after the pandemic. The gym bros were actually tended to be more correct on the pandemic, I guess, at least than a lot of the doctors did. Are you still going or are you done? Are you at like the weight that you want to be at and now you're just kind of sustaining?
So Actually, one thing I didn't tell you is that I signed a modeling contract.
What?
So I signed it in December. And then from that point, I have a friend who's a personal trainer. I was like, well, I want to get in the best shape possible. So he devised a program for me to follow. And so I've been weight training. So my focus went from fasting and losing strictly losing weight to weight training. And I gained some weight. I gained somewhere between, I'm usually fluctuating between 10 and 15 pounds. But I gained some weight back. But I've definitely put on muscle. I've definitely gotten stronger. My physique is starting to change, even in a short period of time, because I'm working out about 4 to 5 times a week. And so next weekend, I know we're going to be releasing this later, but by the time this comes out, the campaign will be released. You'll see the company that I took photos with and everything.
Wow. So, yeah. Oh, that is so cool. Your life is so cool. You have so many cool things going on in your life. And just the way that you've done a 180. When you said you have more people watching you now, do you mean you have more like accountability partners, or you just mean you're more in the public eye, so that motivates you to get in better shape?
I'm more in the public eye.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And my wife has helped me to understand that as well. So like, there have been a bunch of different things that I've done to keep up with my appearance. And as I've felt better as a person, I want to make sure I look better. I've upgraded my wardrobe, got rid of old stuff. Yeah. You know, having a woman in your life makes you have some more style. You know, so anytime I go shopping for clothes, I make sure she's with me.
Yeah.
You know, so just all these different things, like it makes sense. And I agree with her decisions. And I try to keep all that stuff in mind. But even more than just like outward appearance, what I started realizing, especially at the beginning of me trying to lose weight, I talk so much about self-improvement and changing your viewpoint and thinking for yourself. And I talk about all the things like suffering from depression, social anxiety, all these different things, losing my job, becoming unemployed, and improving myself and my mentality. But my one weakness was my weight. And so when I really started getting into it, I was like, this is something I really need to hone in on, and I need to focus on, because, you know, my outward appearance is the leftover remnants of my old self.
That's a money quote. Yeah. That's good. What is your son? Or do you think this is having an impact on your son, the way he's viewing you?
He started, and my son is like me when I was younger. I was like this big, you know, I was a stick.
Yeah.
You know, and my son, he's a stick and he's taller than me. He's like 6'1", but he is going to the gym on his own, right? Cause I'm encouraging him to go to the gym. He might ask me, he's like, you know, what should I take as far as like protein shake? What should I do? And we talk about diet. And so we're starting to have this conversation. He just turned 18 October 1st. So, you know, he got his license and he started driving. He has his own car now.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's way more independent. So now he gets up and he goes to the gym by himself. He goes and does these things. He goes to work. So, you know, when he tells me all these things that he did and I didn't have to tell him to do, it makes me very proud.
Yeah, that's the mark of you. You did a good job raising him. I think that the kind of the gluttony, the obesity problem, which is, I believe, you know, people talk about how a lot of the kind of like feminist gals and like the libs of TikTok type of people, a lot of them tend to be overweight, but I believe statistically still conservatives, like, you know, Bible Belt, the Southern cuisine and all that, people are still more overweight on average than liberals. That is something that people on the right, and especially Christians, I think it's like one of my pet peeve issues, is that we need to be talking about this, and we're all about masculinity, and like I see pastors preaching about you know, don't let them stamp out your masculinity and stuff. But a lot of times the pastor giving the sermon is overweight himself. And I'm like, your physical, your physical presence is a part of your masculinity. Like that's a part of it. It's not just your mentality and that you're based or whatever. the physical part is important too. And it tells me a lot about, like you said, what's going on internally. You know, your outward expression of yourself is really important. So it's one of my pet peeve issues and something that I just think boys need to see their fathers too, being fit, being able to do physical things, which this is totally going on a different tangent, which is why I think a problem that hasn't gotten a lot of attention is that people are talking about how we're not having babies, but even people that are having babies are having them older and older. And I actually think that that's a big problem, having, you know, being like 40 when you have your kids. Now, if you didn't choose that, if you just happened to not meet your wife or whatever till you're older and you couldn't, you know, that's just when it happened for you, that's one thing. But people are purposely waiting, right? Like, I'm not going to have kids till I'm in my late 30s. And I think, especially for boys who are learning how to be masculine, that's a problem when their dad can't keep up with them, when their dad can't beat them in arm wrestling or whatever. And so, in a sense, it was great that you had your son young and that and you're going to get a lot of years with him, and he got to see you go through these different stages of manhood as well, which is really special and something that's getting lost today.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I think that we need to be more mindful as to procreating and the negatives and the benefits of how we're approaching family planning.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the biggest issue with family planning is that we're not family planning. I think that's a much bigger problem. And I think what I'm trying to do is utilize my story to talk about, this is the possible outcome for your child, which, by the way, I never went to jail, never got hooked on drugs, never did any of that stuff. And still, my childhood was extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much to my childhood. My wife says, "Do you realize all the stuff you went through?" And I'm like, I never really think about it all together.
Yeah.
I think about it like, oh yeah, I went through that. Oh yeah, I went through that. But like, we were homeless twice as kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because there's one income, you know, and it always leaves you on the verge. You know, we were in a homeless shelter. My mom had a full-time job as a nurse, you know, because she basically got scammed out of an apartment. She gave them her money and they took her deposit and ran. And we had nowhere else to go. We had to put all of our stuff in storage and stay in a homeless shelter. And we were there for, I think, about 3 months before we got back on our feet. She was able to get enough money. But like, we went through all that stuff. I remember all that stuff. You know, I went to a mental hospital when I was six, you know, and that was something that I blocked out for quite some time. And now I'm trying to talk about it more because I think it's really beneficial to do so. So there's a whole lot that happens because of single parenthood that doesn't involve your kids going to jail or doing drugs, which are just as bad.
Yeah.
But I think what ends up happening is we see these kids who don't go through that and say, well, they turned out fine.
Yeah.
So single parent is not that bad.
Yeah. So no, big mistake. Okay. Lots of great stuff. And we could go on and hopefully we will one day. Hopefully we'll have you back on. I'm sure. Are you writing any other books? Do you have any other kind of publication things in the works?
So I'm going to be doing a second edition of my book where it's more edited. It's better edited. You know, I ended up doing the editing and my wife helped me with the editing, but we're not professional editors. And I know that there are some mistakes, and I would like for my book to be seriously seen and used in like schools and things of that nature.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be working towards releasing a second edition. And after that, I'm going to be working towards having an audiobook. And leaving that there. So I'm not trying to rewrite my book. I just want to clean
it up.
Polish it up. Yeah. And then I'll leave it there. But I do have a second book, a second official book that I'm going back and forth on trying to pitch, maybe to a bigger publisher, where it's strictly about fatherlessness and how it impacts our society.
Yeah.
And it, I started writing it a while ago, and the way I'm writing it sounds like a memoir, but it'll tie into the things that we see in our society, that, you know, whether it's crime, homelessness, drug abuse, things like that, but talk about why it's actually happening. Talk about it from like a mental standpoint, a behavioral standpoint. Why does this actually exist? So a lot in Black Victim, Black Victor, I talk a lot about psychology, human behavior. And granted, I don't have a degree in any of that stuff, but I will tell you that professionals have read my book and said, you're on point. And this is what this is called. And this is what this is called. Because it is something I'm very much so interested in. So that's why I'm able to say, like, when I see this happen, this is what it turns into. And this is why it's important. I'm actually pretty spot on when it comes to that, you know, despite not being technically a psychology professional.
Yeah, well, and I totally reject the idea that you have to have every single credential to talk on every single issue. So, you know, I can read studies, I can understand things, you know, and if I have questions, I can ask questions. Okay, great. So we'll have that to look forward to, and we'll definitely have to have you come back on when you are finished with that project. But for now, we'll move on to the 10 speed round questions, and then we'll give you a chance to put in your final thoughts. And actually, one of these questions, so I have like a list of, it's like 55, 56 questions or something like that. And then I use a random number generator, and that's how I pick people's 10 questions for their episode. One of these questions you kind of already answered, but we'll do it anyways. So are you ready for your 10 speed round questions?
Yes.
Okay. Question number one, Black or African American?
Black.
Black History Month, yay or nay?
Yay.
What would your last meal be?
What would my last meal be? Definitely Turkish.
What is the biggest issue facing Black America today?
Fatherlessness.
Yeah. Where is there systemic racism in America?
Any industry that is controlled by the elites.
What is your favorite cartoon movie?
My favorite cartoon movie? That's a hard one because I don't really want I was never huge on cartoon movies. I can't really think of anything. I'll say Space Jam.
Okay. Is cultural appropriation a good or bad thing?
It's a good thing. I think it's flattery.
What is the worst part of being Black?
When people assume you are what the media portrays.
Do you think BET serves a worthwhile purpose?
It probably used to, but now it's part of the corporate framing of degeneracy.
And your last question, who is the most beautiful woman in the world?
The most beautiful woman in the world? It's so subjective. I have no idea. I don't know. I think there are a lot of beautiful women that are in the world. So
too many to choose from.
It's too many to choose from. Exactly.
All right. Fair enough. Those are your 10 questions. Do you have any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with?
No, just don't doubt yourself. If you want to go for something, go for it. If you want to write, if you want to speak, if you want to say something and you feel it in your heart to do so, then do it. Sometimes you're going to lose people along the way, but I think it's far more important to follow that calling. If you have the calling, then to stay silent, because you'll regret it if you don't.
And you actually, you haven't said this, but you will provide consultation, right? People can actually like set up an appointment with you and get some advice, get some encouragement, tips. I mean, I don't know what all that entails, but if someone's listening and they do want to kind of do what you're doing, you do offer consultation, right?
Yeah, I do writing consultations if need be, if someone wants some help. And I've done some writing coaching for books. A couple people, generally friends of mine, but help them improve on their approach of writing the book.
Yeah, so there's that too. If you're listening and you want to be the next Adam B. Coleman, then you can start that journey with the Adam B. Coleman. So that's on your website, right? There's like a an appointment calendar or something that they can find?
Yeah, on my Substack.
Okay. All right, Adam, thank you so much for being a supporter of Free Black Thought, for coming on. And we love to follow you. We love your work and you're doing great things. Keep it going.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Free Black Thought Podcast.